So this is the last class in this series on the Samantabhadra's vows. And I just this week came across this article by Robert Scharf, who's a professor at Berkeley, Buddhist Studies professor, and he comes periodically to Green Gulch Farm to offer these kind of like interesting and kind of in-depth Buddhist studies topics to the community there, and I've been getting some of the texts emailed, and this is an article that he wrote called On the Allure of Buddhist Relics. So this month's topic for his discussion is this topic of what about Buddha's relics in Buddhism. And his other topics of scholarship for Green Gulch have been more like about how the mind works and Buddhist psychology, and so this is kind of a different topic. And it's not the topic of relics is not maybe so pertinent to our discussion, but some of the things in this article I thought were related. So often as these American Buddhist scholars, they bring in kind of Western take on how things are mixed with traditional Buddhism. So one section of this article he titles The Semiotic Logic of Images, Icons, and Relics. So, you know, semiotic is relating to signs. You know, semiotics is how signs signify phenomena. Signs, literally like street signs, signify that street. They represent that street, the name of the street. Or like a flag, American flag is like a sign or representation of the country. So the study of semiotics is the study of signs. And it's not, you know, the great teachers, kind of philosophers, really, of semiotics, like Derrida and so on, are not particularly referencing Buddhism. But when we were studying mind-only Buddhism with my teacher, Green Gulch, we got into this whole study of semiotics and Jacques Derrida, because he felt like it's totally related. The way that we name things in a way creates what they are. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the study of semiotics. And anyway, this article is on the semiotic logic of images, icons, and relics. And he says here, Robert Scharf, that an icon, he defines icon as a religious image that is believed to partake of or participate in the essence of that which it represents. This is the way these scholars talk. Yeah, an icon. And he's comparing it to an image, like a image is just like a picture of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. But an icon is a religious image that's believed to partake of or participate in the essence of that which it represents. It's not merely a likeness of the divine, but it shares in the very nature of the divine, an icon. And this is what's actually forbidden in some religions. Like I think in Christianity, maybe someone else knows, but I think you're not supposed to make icons of God, although there definitely are Christian icons. I think the word icon maybe is a Christian term. There's icons of saints and Jesus and Mother Mary. And the cross, yeah, representing Jesus, really, right? Well, that's a question. Is it representing or is it actually Jesus? And this is at least his definition of icon, is it's not just representing And I think Judaism, not supposed to make icons of God anyway, because God is formless. And Islam is really big on no icons. Yeah. For an icon, this is Robert Scharf, for an icon, the distance between the signifier and the signified is eliminated. Yeah? Between the sign and the signed, the object that's the sign is for, the distance between the signifier and the signified is eliminated. The essence of the signified is within the sign. In other words, the essence of the Buddha is within the image of the Buddha. It's not just representing it. And he says, Buddhists eliminated the separation between the manifest form and the divine nature by consecrating images through eye-opening ceremonies, which I think all Buddhist traditions do that, as one way of consecrating kind of a piece of wood or stone or metal. Consecrating it means like putting Buddha into it. It kind of inviting actual Buddha nature to enter the image, and then there becomes an icon. So again, this is like, we don't talk about these things so much, I think, in American Buddhism, but I thought it's related to our discussion when we're, because we've been talking about bowing to Buddhas and making offerings to Buddhas in particular, and we enact that every day in the Zendo, you know, relating to the images. So, and I think later in the article he says, you know, modern Western scholars just relate, just say, well, actually all this iconography of Buddhism is really just images representing Buddhas. But he says the more traditional Asian understanding is, it's not just a representation, it's an icon. And made sacred through these consecration rituals and so on. And
more like projecting an essence on it. Projecting an essence on it, making it more of an active kind of a relationship. Rather than reifying the object, it's more of a, you're projecting an essence. It's like, you know, a church has a cathedral, it creates an essence of a place, a setting.
Yeah, and essence is, you know, a somewhat loaded term in Buddhism that can have these different meanings.
Like projecting in like a
inherent existence.
Yeah.
You mean like an intention?
Yeah, like projecting an intention.
Yeah.
If I think of Avalokiteshvara and Abhagavata, I'm thinking maybe compassion, you know, projecting an essence.
The
object. The object itself is still wood. It's the idea of the process.
Yeah, you do it. You do it through your mind and intention. That's right. So and that's kind of in the spirit of everything. Is actually all the manifest world and all the activities of the world arise from the intentions of sentient beings. This kind of basic teaching of the Buddhas. In that spirit, then everything becomes possible. Right, then we can say, I am dotting the I's of that Buddha, and now it's a living Buddha. We can intend that and make it thus. And we say, well, what it, scientifically is that so? But in fact, then that's like scientific materialism to say, well, we can't find a Buddha in there, but we can't find a Buddha in here either, right? We can't find the Buddhas. They don't have form. Yes. Yes, yeah, totally. Yeah, so we might say the one who's puts great intention into opening the eyes with the, I hesitate to use the word belief, because, you know, but the strong intention, may this awaken, may this action awaken this image so that then when we make offerings to it, we're not just kind of symbolically doing that, which would be maybe kind of half-hearted. We're really offering them to Buddha. itself. And through that intention, and then if that's just maybe the person who opens them, but then the assembly, someone might come in and say, "Is that a consecrated Buddha there?" And someone might say, "No, we just put it there." And then, "Oh, well then forget it." And say, "Yes, yes, it is." And, "Oh." Some might say that.
If you practice, you will see Buddha close to you.
Yeah.
You see, like my father, anything happened, Buddha come and tell him, you know, to protect him. See? And my mother, she pray, but she's not good. You know, she abused me. And she just spend the money and run around, you know, different people, mess around. And and that's why she never see Buddha. You know, when I tell her, I see Buddha come.
Because it comes from the intention of the person. Yeah, faith, we could say.
Buddha don't ask you anything. Mm-hmm. You know? But you offer flower, you offer the incense, and you pray to Buddha. Buddha will love you.
Yeah, faith is very similar to intention. Yeah, I think faith is a kind of intention.
1945, when Japanese went over there and take over French colony, and here we have 9:10, you know, Buddha come and tell my father that you have to really to get up in the morning, something come up. Then my father, he get up in the morning and he go and bury, make a hole, he dig the hole in the back house, and he put the money, jewelry, diamond, everything, because he's a man. My father, he's a man. He long people. Money to buy house, buy farm, buy everything, you know. And that old house, they know my father. But my father, he's a good man. That's why Buddha come and go here and protect him. Then in the morning, he dig the hole and he buried everything. I look, what my father know? You know, and I go outside, and the bad Vietnamese, they go around, they hurt, they kill people. They burn the house. If somebody fight with them, they burn the house.
See if you can shorten the story a little.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but that's why I say what happened. Mm-hmm. I love with my father.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we all come down here. We have a karma. We have to pay, you know, like my family. I have a lousy mother. She abused me, she hit me, but I never tell my father. You know, 4 or 5 years. She changed me like a lot. And I have a sister. We born two together. You know, only 15 minutes, and she came. Every afternoon, with 3 or 4 years, we like to go to the neighbor to pray, to play with the friend. But she don't let us. She came us like a dog. Every afternoon, we was sit home. But she stay home, then we're free. And we have a stepmother. My father leave her alone. You know, he very nice to her. You know. But she like to mess around.
Well, anyway, Lakshmi, I think we understand the ideas that relating to Buddha, we receive some response like that.
That's why I love my father. I practice very strong. You know, I'm a young girl, 17, 18, totally I'm here. You know, like a Muslim, you see. I have a boyfriend, you know, he put the voodoo and I go with him and I have two kids with him. And later, he want to control me because my father have a lot of money. And after this, when I meet one guru and he tell me what happened, then he give me something to protect. Then later, when I had my son 3 months, and he have a first wife in India, the wife from India come to look for him, he don't want her. He
wants me. I think what Lakshmi tells us over and over again is how alive this devotional practice has been for you. And it's something that we have to cultivate. It's not to practice.
And I'm very pleased, very happy because I learned from my father. The letter and meet many guru, you know. Yeah. So, and they look at me like, they tell me, you have to practice, grow to look at.
And, you know, Robert Scharf says, from ancient times, in ancient China and so on, the Buddhist practitioners, kind of scholar practitioners, would struggle with ways to talk about this. But he said that most people didn't need complicated explanations for why. They just relate to the icons in this way. But I think in a place like America, at least people like me do need more explanations. So one of the things he says here is that the way that explain, for example, how can Buddha, like one Buddha, manifest as like thousands of relics or thousands of stupas and thousands of icons? And the ancients said it's this three kaya theory that we've talked about some. The Dharmakaya is boundless and formless, but it can manifest infinite nirmanakayas, which are these, you know, manifestation bodies that can include wooden images that can come alive through intention, for example. So that's all in this discussion of semiotics and iconography. And even in Soto Zen, he says the usual way of translating icon in Japanese is Honzan. And which originally came from Vajrayana Buddhism in China and Japan, where it's like an actual living image. But then all schools of Buddhism in East Asia took on that term. So in the Soto Zen teachings, they call the Buddha on the altar the Honzan, the kind of like almost like original deity or something like this. So yes.
So would this apply to things like Arakasu, which we obviously relate to differently, and rose we relate to differently than other items of clothing? It's not just like a sticker that says, yep, we did your Jukai like it's not like a sticker that says, I voted.
It's not?
No. It's not like, yep, this is just...
It could be for some people, right? Yeah, and then is it a symbol or a sign, or is it an actual Buddha? We put so much intention into it, taking refuge with each stitch, and then we venerate it by putting it on top of our head and reciting this verse of venerating the robe as a kind of a Buddha, the way Dogen talks about it too.
You hold it carefully.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they say after you wash it, if it gets dirty over time, you wash it, and then there's a whole ritual. You put it on an altar, you offer flowers and incense to the robe, and you circumambulate around it just to like kind of re-purify it after you washed it. So this is how Dogen relates to this piece of cloth.
It would become important for your intention. It would be important for your intention, but to someone else it might not matter.
Yeah, Again,
it's like individual.
Totally individual, yep. And then, you know, in cultures where that's common, it may be that, like Dogen talks about, you know, when like a demon, like a kind of negative energy comes in the form of some like spirit trying to kind of distract us from practice, when that so-called demon sees and even like a thread from Buddha's robe, they get freaked out and run away. So this is in our Zen tradition, but how do we relate to things like that, you know?
Could I ask Rachel what you seem curious when I said that, so I'm just wondering what
you're... I was just like, I'm listening to this and it feels like we're swimming like among three paradigms like at the same time. Your robe, like the emperor is wearing no clothes paradigm, actually it is just a sticker and it's not even that. Or the skillful means that Ken said, like,
I've heard, like, you wear it to make it so, and that's a good thing, so accept that it's actually just fabric, but it does good. And then what Kokyo is saying, that, like,
it's a deity.
It is.
Or a Buddha.
So I'm like, yeah, I'm just curious about...
Yeah, I think that's a nice way to put it. Three paradigms. I think there's actually three in there that you caught, yeah.
So is it okay to just, however we want, use the world as we do, just without responsibility? So what might be true or...
In the big sense, it's okay in the way that everything is okay. But in the sense of skillful means, trying to free all beings from suffering and awaken all beings to... Buddha's wisdom, then we have to start looking at, yeah, every action, every intention we do and every action we do, like, is it leading in that direction? And so I think this way to see these, the ordinary way is just a piece of cloth and just a piece of wood on the altar. And the other two, you could say, are two different types of skillful means. And one is maybe a more of kind of like, logical, skillful means that we can understand in our culture. And the third, this level of like things become Buddhas, is like beyond rationality.
It could also become dangerous, you know, when people deify.
Yeah, I can.
Yeah. Because they'll kill you.
Mm. Yeah. Or become super attached to it.
Yeah.
Like then, you know, and in Zen we have stories like that, right? Somebody, you know, it's a consecrated image of the Buddha, and somebody's like, I'm cold, and that there's, it makes good firewood. So they burn the Buddha. And Zen, this is kind of after the whole tradition got into this thing of like, these are like sacred, consecrated images, and we'll get too attached to them. So then the Zen tradition is like, kind of in a way going back to, well, actually it's just a piece of wood. In a way it comes full circle, I think. And a piece of wood, but sometimes we make very respectful offerings, take very good care, and then sometimes we can burn it to warm up on a cold night. So, all about the situation in the moment, we could say.
One of the things I really enjoyed learning when I was selling my rakasu with Norman was that it consists of five or seven jo, which are rice fields. Each one of these, and so it's meant to be a living organism in that one sense, where the rice grows productively if we cultivate it and take care of our practice, our inner practice, as well as relying on the rice we need to eat every day just to sustain our physical being.
That's part of this symbolic,
the two together.
symbolic representational imagery. Yeah.
And on the back, of course, is your name and all of that stuff, so it's very personal.
And would it make sense if we really took this idea of the icon to its full extension, that then we would just relate to everything in the same way? So we would respectfully pick up everything with a sense of it being Buddha. Or does that feel like that's going too far?
Maybe that would be a fourth paradigm. Where now not just some specially consecrated objects are Buddhas, but then everything is. And which again almost comes back full circle to the everything's very ordinary.
With special appreciation of it.
Yeah, of everything. Yeah, and there are Dharma teachings that teach that way of like, pure perception, more like Vajrayana teaching, pure perception. Everybody is actually a fully realized Buddha. All the environment is the fully manifest celestial palace of the Buddhas. And so all sound is Buddha mantra sound, even though it just sounds ordinary often to us. It's kind of like everything is totally sacred and pure and perfected. And I think we, in Zen too, we find teachings that point in that direction. Yeah.
You said that, like, everything is sacred and everything like that. And I kind of got that idea, actually, like, you know, Rigosh Tosahara, because we bow to everything. And I remember getting up and like, mad. You know, like, I don't want to bow to the bathroom thing, you know, it's like stupid. Yeah, and then I realized everything's sacred. Yeah. I'd be bowing all day and day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, I feel like.
And the bowing just reminds us that it is sacred. Yeah. Yeah. And the last point in this article of Robert Sharpe just is like, this section is called Relics or Icons and their Hermeneutic Conundrum. He says, even in modern science, we have this mind-body problem. Like, what's the relationship of mind and body? And even in modern science, we can't get at that. We can't really say, is there some difference? How do they connect? Almost like mentality and materiality. It's always been a problem in spiritual traditions and science. And because of this unclarity of this mind-body connection, it was unclear in ancient times too. So can we say, can there be a Buddha mind that connects to a wooden image as its body, for example? And he says, the icons, like the wooden Buddha, is not just a representation of the deity any more than our body is a representation of me as a person. I thought that was interesting. You know, this body is not really me, but it represents me. We don't think or talk that way. So you could apply it. You could creatively open to the possibility of relating to all things in that way. So that's just a modern person's reflections on some of these strange ancient ideas. So we went through a bunch of these vows, and they're what the different mental obscurations that they are antidotes for. Like, the vow to respectfully bow to all Buddhas is a kind of antidote or kind of medicine or way of working with this obscuration of
pride,
and the vow to praise all Buddhas and their virtues. I think we could include that also with pride. The vow to extensively make offerings to all Buddhas.
Generosity.
It's an antidote to
greed
or stinginess. The vow to confess and repent karmic hindrances is an antidote to
regret.
Well, what's it an antidote for? Anger and hate.
The five things are greed, hate, delusion, pride, and jealousy.
Yeah.
Mm. Those are the only choices.
And we could add it. We could also.
Well, let's stay on track here.
We could add in a sixth too called doubt.
Doubt. That'd be fine.
It's all the hindrances.
Yeah. So I think it's true that karmic, confessing and repenting karmic hindrances, you could say, is an antidote to all of them.
Yeah.
But they single out this one of anger or hatred, particularly because that's maybe the main thing to acknowledge and to regret and resolve not to harm others. It's the most harmful in a way. And the vow to rejoice in the merit and virtue of others is an antidote to jealousy. And the vow to request the turning of the Dharma wheel, the wheel of teachings, is an antidote to delusion. We need the Dharma to help develop understanding. And the vow to request that the Buddhas remain in the world. We could put that also in delusion, sometimes they say like, holding false views, almost the same,
like
wrong view.
Pride as well, because you're requesting
yeah.
to remain and help.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I can't do it by myself.
Yeah. I think there's overlap between a lot of them, actually. Mm-hmm. And then, So usually when they list these antidotes, they don't go through all 10 because there's this other system where there's just 7. And in the system of 7 vows, the first 2 are combined into 1. And then so then there's 6 others, and the last one of them is dedication, which comes at the end here, dedication to merit. And one version says that's an antidote to doubt. And that was hard for me to understand, but one commentary said it's an antidote to doubt because one may doubt what will be the result of our positive actions. So that's like the merit is doing positive activity, but we might doubt, well, is there some result to this? And if we dedicate the merit to an end, like the awakening of all beings or whatever, then we have, maybe, then there's less doubt of what's the result of the, it's kind of like directing the result of the positive energy, so there's less doubt about where it goes or how it results. That one may be a little stretch. I don't think I would have come up with that. But to make the system of all these kleshas work, it's one way to look at it. And so in this first column of this text, there is the part after the 7th one of the vow to request the Buddhas to remain in the world. There's a 4-line stanza. And then we could just end it with this, the vow to dedicate all merit is by bowing, praising, and making offerings to the Buddhas. This is, do you see where that is near the end of the first
end of the column? Okay.
It's going through all the 6 that came before. Bowing, praising, making offerings to Buddhas by requesting that they remain and turn the wheel of teaching, by repenting and rejoicing. Those are all the ones that came earlier in that column. By those practices, whatever good I have accumulated, I dedicate it all to living beings and the way of Buddhas. Or another translation says, I dedicate this merit to all living beings and the full awakening, and their full awakening. Or I dedicate it to the enlightenment of all beings. So that's why I thought it was nice to just recite this first column, kind of covers almost all of it. But then we have in the usual like Chinese way of counting 10 vows, you have this 8 and 9 are kind of strewn through the rest of this these verses. This is from chapter 39, as it says here, of the Flower Ornament Sutra, and some Indian Sanskrit versions of the sutra have a 40th chapter called Samantabhadra's like 10 vows, in which they list these 10, but in it they list them as 10, and they call number 8 the vow to always practice the teachings of the Buddhas, or the vow to always study with the Buddhas, and 9 as the vow to always accord with living beings. So how exactly that dynamically all fits together is somewhat open to interpretation. Like, I think it's quite clear where all of these 7 fit into this text, but 8 and 9, where I put them in here according to one, actually American Zen teacher had put these headings in here, so I don't know if he actually made that up or if he got it from some traditional commentary, but I think it does work where these are put in, but also I think we could look at it as starting down at the bottom of, just after that dedication that to all living beings in the way of Buddhas, starting there, learning from all Buddhas, fulfilling the practice of good, I will practice pure conduct, always free from defect, and so on. We could say right there, when I've been, studying this text, I think we could say that that's the vow to always practice the teachings of the Buddhas, or to always, literally it says like, study and practice with the Buddhas, or learn from the Buddhas. So we could start it right there to have no gap, and just go through, all these next lines. May the Buddhas of the past be honored as well as those now in the worlds of the 10 directions. May Buddhas of the future be at ease, filled with joy, having realized enlightenment. I will study with them in the past, future, and present and future, and quickly realize enlightenment. I could say study and practice, learn with them. May all the lands of the 10 directions be purified, supreme, and filled with Buddhas and enlightening beings, bodhisattvas, at the tree of enlightenment. May all beings in the 10 directions be happy and well, without worry. May all beings' righteous aims be successful, and all afflictions cleared away. As I am carrying out enlightenment practice, may I recall my lives in all states. In every lifetime, as I die and am reborn, may I always transcend the mundane with pure conduct. Transcend the mundane here in Chinese is shuke, which means leaving home. So it could mean like, and I think other translations say, be ordained, may I always be ordained. Here it's just in general, leave all, you know, you could say that our comfy home of habitual obscurations. Mm-hmm. That may I always be free from anything that binds me, you could say, in lifetime after lifetime. And pure conduct is kai, you know, precepts. And then we could start number 8, the practice of teachings of Buddha there, or in looking at this again myself, if I was putting in these headings, I might put number 9 there. We could say that practicing the teachings of all Buddhas, the 8th vow, includes all of these wonderful aspirations, but just any practice that we're doing, right? One commentary says, Sila, Samadhi, and Prajna, you know, virtue, presence, and knowing, we could translate it as, or the 6 paramitas, all of these practices that we do with the Buddhas. And then the 9th one, the vow to always accord with living beings, I think it could start where number 8 is here, because now it's not just talking about Buddhas. Now it's saying this way of benefiting beings. I will expound the teaching, the Dharma, in the languages of gods and dragons. That's devas and nagas. In the languages of demons or yakshas and humans and of all living beings. So basically now it's not just wishing that the Buddhas be happy and well. Now it's like I will try to benefit beings. And we could say, do we have to really learn like Naga language to teach the Nagas and the demon languages and so on? And maybe we could understand the meaning of it too as just like find skillful ways to meet all different types of beings. That's one way to hear, like learning the languages of different types of species might be like, well, if we had some really like angry, crazed, angry person running down the street in a really violent way. We sometimes see them around here. Finding the language to meet them, right, and help them somehow. Might be like, hey, what do you mean? Or like, you want an apple? They might hit you or something. So that skillful means is maybe very difficult in that kind of situation, but that's the vow. You could hear that's part of the vow to accord with living beings, is I vow to learn through my presence and openness and compassion and wisdom. May I learn the language of this crazed, angry person in some way that I might be able to meet them and help relieve their anger. The languages of demons and humans and all living beings. May those engaged in the transcendent perfections, that's the 6 paramitas. Another translation says, may I engaged in the 6 paramitas not stray from enlightenment. and may all harmful obstructions be thoroughly extinguished. I will traverse the paths of the world free from compulsion, affliction, and delusion, like a lotus unstained by water, like the sun and moon unhindered in the sky. You could say that the sun and the moon are do their activity, they interact with us sentient beings, but they're unhindered as they pass through the boundless empty sky. So you could, like the sun and the moon are, you could say, in the world but not of it, yeah, as they sometimes say. Sun and the moon, and the lotus unstained by water, similarly, like in the world but not of it, benefiting others without being harmed, or living in samsara without being harmed by samsara. May we be this way. Extinguishing all the miseries of bad states and bringing all beings to happiness, I will act for the welfare of all beings in all lands everywhere. According with the conduct of sentient beings, which really made me think that that should be under the heading here of this ninth, right, which is called according with living beings. According with the conduct of sentient beings while fulfilling the practice of enlightenment and cultivating the practice of good, thus will I act throughout future eons. So there's some of the Indian commentaries, like the one by supposedly Nagarjuna, has each of these four line stanzas is like a different heading. They're not within the 10 vows, but they're like, it's another list of 16, like aspects of bodhisattva practice, like benefiting sentient beings here. This may I always be in communion with those who share my practice with body, speech, and mind. I will carry out vows as one practice. That's the practice of connecting with all bodhisattvas. It says, communing with those who share my practice. May I always, like, hang around other bodhisattvas. Mm-hmm. It's good to have a sangha, yes, to practice, sure, with. In communion. May I always be with my benefactors who teach me the practice of good. May I never displease them. So it's like, I think benefactors, there's like Kalyana Mitra, the good friends and teachers. May I always see the Buddhas face to face, surrounded by enlightening beings. I will make fine offerings to them forever unwearied. So invoking the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and making offerings. Preserving the true teaching of Buddhas, illuminating the practice of enlightenment, and purifying the practice of good, I will practice for all future eons. Migrating through all states of being, having acquired inexhaustible virtue and knowledge, may I become an inexhaustible treasure of wisdom and means, or prajna and upaya, skillful means. Concentration, wisdom, and all virtues. That's the treasury of wisdom and means. Oh, may I become an inexhaustible treasury of wisdom and means, concentration, liberation, and all virtues. All these wonderful qualities. As I carry on the practice of enlightenment, may I see the inconceivable Buddhas sitting among enlightening beings in the lands as numerous as atoms that are in each atom. So it's, you know, it's somewhat repetitive, but it's, I think it's like the spirit of, I like, you know, reciting the whole thing sometimes. Yeah, and just the feeling of just this kind of boundless quality of all these vows. Like, I really am not holding back with devotion. It's very devotional expression of this bodhisattva. Thus may I perceive the oceans of Buddhas and lands of all times at each point in the 10 directions as I practice for myriad eons. May I ever penetrate the eloquence of Buddhas, the voices of all Buddhas which adapt to intentions, the purity of articulation of all Buddhas by the sounds of the ocean of tones in a single utterance. Into those infinite voices of all Buddhas of all times, may I enter by Buddha power, turning the wheel of teaching. May I enter all eons of the future instantly, and may I act in all eons of all times within an instant. So instead of, we might imagine like throughout all this infinite future time, there's all these beings to benefit. Let's do it all right now.
Yeah. And the past too.
And the past too, yeah. So it's entering the inconceivable realm where our limitations of time and space don't have to hinder us. It can benefit all beings in the 10 directions and 3 times without moving or through time or space. Inconceivable, but like, may I be able to do this? This is like the extent of this vow. Like, how will I do that? I'm not sure. But I'd like to be able to be of that much benefit. Maybe the Buddhas can help me. Into those, may I ever penetrate the eloquence of Buddhas, the voices of all Buddhas which adapt to intentions, the purity of articulation of all Buddhas, by the sounds of the tone, ocean of tones in a single utterance. Into those infinite voices of all Buddhas of all times, may I enter by Buddha power, turning the wheel of teaching. May I enter all eons of the future instantly, and may I act in all eons of all times within an instant. May I see all Buddhas of all times in one instant and always enter their sphere by the magical power of liberation. May I produce the arrays of all lands of all times in an atom. May I thus perceive all the arrays of Buddha lands in all the 10 directions, learning the teachings of the lamps of the worlds to come. That's an epithet of Buddha. I will visit all the guides who have passed away to eternal rest. Yes.
Do you think this is talking about transcending time and space, or is it just giving an example of really amazing things?
It sounds like the vow to transcend time and space to me, right? May I, in order to benefit beings, right? May I, enter all these future times in one instant? Because we could say, if we really want to, if we're just, all we wish for is to benefit all beings throughout space and time in every possible way as soon as possible, because might say, but the future beings aren't suffering yet, so why do we have to benefit them now? But I think I hear it as not just random miraculous powers, but as more like the vast scale of the compassionate wish to benefit.
Okay. I think what was behind my question was when we say the entire universe in a cup of tea.
Yeah.
Kind of thing?
Yeah.
Is it talking about that?
That could be a simple Zen way of talking about this point, yeah. Transcending time and space is the whole universe in a cup of tea. So, yeah, that's maybe a Zen expression of transcending time and space. Yeah. I want, what does that mean? It's like everything is included.
So that everything we do is...
If we have that vow or intention, it could be that
taking
everything...
Taking care of things when you're doing something. Yeah. Taking care of something, being mindful of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and taking care of that with the intention that may everything else benefit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my teachers sometimes say, when in a group of people, and a bunch of people are wanting to talk to him, and he feels like, actually, these people are disappointed because they can't talk to him, because he's talking to this person. That actually he said he'll try to invoke that kind of spirit of may my meeting this person right here really fully and presently, may that benefit all these people who aren't talking to me right now. I think that's the same kind of vow. May this one, this one activity, just instead of oh, hold on a second, what was that? Oh yes, yeah, what was it? then we get all scattered, right? Drink, I think that's the tea image too, right? There's a, this Thich Nhat Hanh's, maybe image, is that, Is that? I think it might be Thich Nhat Hanh's. From a distance. Not, you know, I didn't get to talk with him. But he, I think this might be from him that, or drinking a cup of tea, I save all beings. Maybe that's Thich Nhat Hanh. And I think that's you know, he's in the situation where all these face such horrific situations of war and suffering and so many people dying needlessly. And like, how do you respond to all that? Really drink this cup of tea fully. It has its danger, I think, too, because then we can get into this kind of Zen preciousness of like, well, forget about the dying people and just drink your tea and nothing, and never do anything else. So, but Thich Nhat Hanh's a nice example, because sometimes he goes out and helps the people. And but when it's time, we could say, when it's time to drink the tea, you just drink the tea, including the universe.
If you're just drinking tea and you're taking care of everything, then there's, you know, like the likelihood of war, it's not going to happen, so to speak. It's kind of a faith, I think.
Yeah, kind of a faith.
Care of the moment, mm-hmm. Then those kind of things don't really happen.
Yeah, at least right around you.
Yeah.
Right around the tea drinker, there, things are pretty peaceful. And you could say the more they're really fully drinking the tea, maybe that circle, that mandala of effect is even wider, to the point where maybe it actually does stop the war way on the other side of the world. Our intention is such a big part.
May it. Everybody pray, everybody do good, and the world will be stopped.
Yeah.
Some people do good, some people don't.
That's right, we have to do even more to make up for the people who aren't. We have to do it for them, too.
And did you say that devotion is a synonym for attention?
I think it's related. It's in the past, we talked about it like... But I think a certain kind of...
I mean, that's kind of how I think about it.
Intention. Mm-hmm. Or I think vow in particular... I think vow really does mean like a kind of strong intention.
Aspiration.
Aspiration too, yeah. And devotion is related to that. And, maybe.
I guess before the devotion, mm-hmm. has that quality of like sticking in something, like, you know.
Yeah.
Something. So
yeah.
It's a difficult word for me.
Yeah, wholehearted intention.
Intention seems to work.
Intention, yeah. Also, I think another kind of angle on it, we might have talked about before, is like open-heartedness, maybe a way of looking at devotion in a more down-to-earth way. Like, I'm devoted to this activity means my heart's open to this activity. Almost like, and it can be a practice, and they're like, actually, I don't really like this activity, and I'd rather not be doing this, but like, okay, let me just try. Just let the heart open just a little bit. More like open to the situation is a little bit of devotion to it. I think it is like, has that heart quality, as opposed to like just a intellectual sort of understanding, right? Devotion has this other sense. So then, here's one place we could put the vow to always accord with living beings. Again, practice with all the Buddhas is so all-inclusive, and then to always accord with living beings is also so all-inclusive. In a way, this 8 and 9, maybe, you know, the Chinese, in particular in this Flower Ornament Sutra, they were really into the making list of 10. And I heard that it was around the time that these sutras were coming out that the decimal system was actually discovered. Oh. Yeah. So, and these numbers like 0 and 10 and 0 and 1 and 10 and how, you know, multiplying 10 by 10 starts expanding like this. So it's 10 almost kind of represents like infinity. So all through this Flower Ornament Sutra, there's thousands of tens of thousands of lists of 10. And so maybe it was like, you know, the original one didn't have these bold headings here, a list of 10. And so we're like, this is such a beautiful vow, poetic vow. Let's, you know, make it into a list of 10. And you could say the 7 are pretty obvious, but these two, in a way, are the summary of all the others. to always practice the Buddha's practices is like the summary. That's kind of in the ultimate realm, we could say. And then according with living beings is all the things in the relative world that are of benefit. Yunmen, the ancient Zen ancestor, said, what was the teaching throughout the Buddha's whole lifetime? And he said, an appropriate response.
Yes, yeah.
Or it's translated in different ways, but an appropriate response, you could say, is that that's a Zen way of talking about this vow to always accord with living beings. Mm-hmm. That was the Buddha's teaching, was he always just responded appropriately to each situation involving suffering beings. And one commentary says, this doesn't, you know, some people might say according with living beings means there's all these vows about we're going to become this Buddha that can transcend time and space, right? And so according with living beings sounds like, no, we can't, we have to like be in the sentient being realm where it basically a deluded realm. You know, sentient beings are in Buddhism generally defined as deluded. There's no such thing, you know, strictly speaking, at least in the kind of Indian presentation of sentient being. There's no such thing as an enlightened sentient being. It's like, then they're a Buddha, and you have Buddhas and sentient beings. Mm-hmm. Sentient beings are kind of like, by definition, deluded and not Buddhas. Now, of course, in the Zen teachings and the non-dual traditions, then we say, well, sentient beings in their true nature actually are Buddhas. Yeah. In the Buddha nature teachings, they even say, in the Indian, you know, pre-Zen Indian treatises, one of the synonyms for Buddha nature is sentient being. But then there's other teachings that say, interestingly, this is how dynamic the Buddha nature thing is. Sentient being is a synonym for Buddha nature, but other ancestors say to realize our Buddha nature completely, one has to remove the sentient being. The way to realize Buddha nature is to remove sentient being. So that's only a more dualistic way of putting it. But how dynamic, right? Some people say sentient being is a synonym for Buddha nature because the true nature of the sentient being is Buddha nature. Some say in order to realize this, you know, unobscured Buddha nature, you have to remove the obscurations to Buddha nature. And sentient being is another name for the obscurations to Buddha nature. So it's good, nice to contemplate both ways and understand that the skillful means behind both those interpretations. That's all they are anyway. They're just concepts to help people. So the commentaries say, according with living beings doesn't mean like we have to stay deluded because that's what according, if we're going to be one with the sentient beings, then they're deluded. So we have to stay deluded. You know, again, this is a kind of dynamic point, because in some ways you could say that's the bodhisattva vow, is to remain in the cycle of illusory samsara to help sentient beings. But there's this way where, again, maybe a little bit like this phrase, in the world but not of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In appearing in delusion but not really deluded. That is the vow anyway, right? As the bodhisattva, I've had to realize the illusoriness of me as a sentient being and everybody else as a sentient being in order to free all of us from grasping sentient beings like ourselves. Staying close and helping without like falling into believing the delusion of sentient beings. So compassion, serving and accommodating, and So actually, like, helping the poor and sick and all sentient beings of the six realms. Sometimes we, like, are there actually, like, hungry ghosts that we need to be fed? Well, we don't know for sure, but if there are, let's give them lots of food. the animal realm, if there's crickets that are about to be killed, let's just release some. And we can't save them all, but in the spirit of, like, all sentient beings, let's try to relieve suffering.
Do that here.
Yeah. Cool. And in this chapter 40, you know, which we could have studied this instead of this chapter 39, where it actually lists the 10 vows. It's just not as it's more repetitive and not as inspirational poetry, it felt like to me, but since we haven't heard it so far, this is the Avatamsaka Sutra, chapter 40, and it's Samantabhadra, Bodhisattva, speaking and saying to Sudana, this pilgrim, again, O noble-minded child of Buddha, in what manner should one accommodate and serve sentient beings? To do so, one should think, and interestingly, every one of these 10 vows starts with that same paragraph. Each one of them says, one should think, and then there's this whole paragraph in quotes. And I was listening to Tenshin Roshi's talks on this, and he says, note the fact that bodhisattvas vow to think. Because, you know, Zen students often feel like, well, we're supposed to not think, right? We're supposed to, like, give up all thinking. That's the highest practice. And sometimes, in Zazen, we can think of not thinking. But in this case, bodhisattvas also vow to think in this way. Throughout the Dharma realm and the realm of space, in the ocean-like cosmoses in the 10 directions, there are infinite kinds of sentient beings born from eggs, the wombs, moisture, and metamorphosis, living by earth, water, fire, wind, space, trees, or flowers. Countless kinds, infinite are their forms, shapes, bodies, faces, longevities, races, names, dispositions, sexual orientations? Doesn't say that. Views, knowledge, desires, inclinations, manners, costumes, and diets. They abide in numerous kinds of dwellings, in towns, villages, cities, and palaces. They comprise devas, nagas, humans, non-humans, with 2 feet, 4 feet, many feet, with form, without form, with thoughts or without thoughts. To all these infinite kinds of beings, I will render my service and accommodate them in whatever way is beneficial to them. I will provide them with all they need and serve them as though serving my parents, teachers, or even the arhats and tathagatas, all equally without discrimination. Yeah, isn't it amazing? To the sick, I will be a good physician. To those who've lost their way, I will show them the right path. To the wanderers in darkness, I will light the light. And to the poor and needy, I will open a treasury. It's in these ways that a bodhisattva should benefit all beings without discrimination. Why? This is the part after this list that I thought was kind of interesting with this one. Let's say, because it does seem a little different than all the other vows are talking about Buddhas, right? I think they're all talking about relating to Buddhas. This one's talking about relating to sentient beings. Why? Because if a bodhisattva accommodates sentient beings, accords with sentient beings as such, she is then making sincere offerings to all Buddhas. Mm. That's why. Don't forget, this is offering to Buddha too. If she respects and serves sentient beings, she's paying respect and serving all the Buddhas. If she makes sentient beings happy, she's making all the Buddhas happy. Why? Because the essence of Buddhahood consists of great compassion. because of sentient beings, a great compassion is aroused. Because of great compassion, bodhicitta, the intention to awaken, is aroused. Because bodhicitta, supreme Buddhahood, is achieved. This is like a great tree in the wilderness. If its roots are well watered, it will flourish in full foliage, blossom, and bear plentiful fruit. So it is with the great Bodhi tree, not the Indian Bodhi tree, but the tree of awakening. All sentient beings are its roots, and all the bodhisattvas and tathagatas are its flowers and fruits. If a bodhisattva applies the water of compassion to help sentient beings, the awakening tree will bear the fruit of the Buddha's wisdom. So, I thought that's a nice image, that the sentient beings are the roots. Yeah, sentient beings are the roots of the awakening tree, and the flowers and fruit are, the flowers, you could say, are the bodhisattvas. They start to come out, and then inside, behind the flower, a fruit starts to bellowing. That's the Buddhas. And you could say, in the end, the flower, the bodhisattva flower drops off, and you just have a Buddha fruit. Mm-hmm. So, a nice image for this tree. That you can't have Buddha fruits, or bodhisattva flowers without the roots of sentient beings. Because mm-hmm. the whole point of Buddhas is compassion for sentient beings. Mm-hmm. Like the Lotus Sutra says, right, that the Buddhas appear in the world for this one great matter of awakening sentient beings to Buddha's wisdom.
So then what happens when all sentient beings are
saved? Yeah, you could say, yeah, it seems like, I don't think the Buddhas maybe ever say, because yeah, don't imagine that. I've heard this question before, and maybe they don't talk about it because there's probably not much likelihood of it happening, even though it's the vow, and we kind of hope for this. And I think it might, I've heard people ask this sometimes before, and I think my teacher said something, and they almost ask it in like, wouldn't that be kind of disappointing because there'd be no more world, or it would be like the end of everything as we know it, in a way. And I think he said something like, it doesn't mean that there's nothing, that the whole universe just like extinguishes because there's nothing left to feed it. It's just, we can't imagine. I think is what he said. We can't imagine what would be. we could imagine a bunch of people being really kind to each other, but even that's like kind of limited, it seems like.
Numberless.
Yeah, they're numberless. They're numberless. You don't have to worry about everything disappearing.
Even with a decimal system, we can't.
Yeah. Or what's that? There's some Dharma joke, right? Of like the last, that like basically all these, everyone starts, you know, becoming bodhisattvas and saving everybody else, and they become Buddhas, and they don't come back, and they're not reborn anymore, right? And then there's only two left on the planet, or in the universe, right? There's two bodhisattvas left, and they're both like, after you. And the other one's like, no, after you. And so they're stuck there forever. The last two.
Are they male, lesbian, or queer?
We don't know. They're beyond those categories at that point. Yeah. Yeah. It wouldn't be so bad, probably. Sentient beings are the roots of the Bodhi, of the awakening tree. And so this... By miraculous supernatural power, swift in all ways, by the power of knowledge, or the vehicles all sided, by the power of conduct or practice with all virtues, by the power of universal love, by the power of goodness all pure, by the power of knowledge unobstructed, by the power of concentration, wisdom, and means, gathering the power of enlightenment, clearing away the power of karma actions, I could say through repentance, destroying the power of afflictions, klesha, and impairing the power of demons or mara. So some of these positive powers and some of the powers that we're actually overcoming, probably in Sanskrit, this is very, it has a poetic feeling. May I fulfill all the powers of the practice of good, purifying oceans of lands or Buddha fields, liberating oceans of beings, learning oceans of teachings, plumbing oceans of knowledge, perfecting oceans of practices, fulfilling an ocean of vows, serving oceans of Buddhas. May I practice untiring for oceans of eons. And so on. I won't read through all of this because we don't have time. But expression. The last lines in that column say, as long as the earth, or another translation says, as long as space exists, as long as all beings exist, as long as karma and klesha, actions and afflictions exist, so long will my vow remain. So that's kind of like Megan's questions. If all these things don't exist anymore, then we can, then everything's gone. There's no vow needed. And then the beginning of the next last column, right at the top, let me give the Buddhas all worlds in the 10 directions adorned with jewels. This is, you could say, is the commentary say, is the benefits of this vow. It goes through some... on hearing this supreme dedication, seeking supreme enlightenment, those who develop respect and devotion will be most blessed. They will auspiciously be born as humans and like the Bodhisattva Samantabhadra and so on. So it's like celebrating. And then it comes down to this 10th final vow, the vow to universally dedicate all merit and virtue to all sentient beings. And then this is this long list of dedication. This whole last part is like a dedication here, dedication of merit. And we talked about merit some before, right? Is the results of virtuous actions, which we could say is, when we look at that, is the joy, the happiness that comes from virtuous actions. We can wish to share the joy from virtuous actions is a way of talking about dedication of merit. I wish to share this joy. I dedicate the merit of the actions. That's, I think, a practical way to look at it. Other people say it's like, merit is like the ability is that comes from virtuous actions, the ability to hear, contemplate, and practice the Dharma. And it arrives, this ability comes from any action that opens us to reality. So it's, some say it's not just necessarily any virtuous, beneficial action, but particularly with the intention to open us to the Buddha's truth as much as possible. You could say maybe any good action does do that, but if it has that opening intention, it particularly creates this ability to open to more Dharma. Or merit can be called the virtuous propensities or inclinations or tendencies accumulated by skillful effort or readiness, even readiness for the next practice. And so that's punya in Sanskrit or kudoku in Japanese, merit and virtue. And then dedicating is this term in Sanskrit, parinamana, parinamana, or in Japanese, echo. We talk about echo, E-K-O, echo, which means, they both mean to dedicate, or literally to like to transfer or turn over. I think in the Gita we do, it has it, turning over these offerings to all sentient beings. So picture, they have these bowls of offerings and turn it over. So it's maybe not such a good English translation, but it means to turn over, like they receive, the hungry ghosts receive an offering, and may you then turn it over to others, share it, basically. So transfer, turn over, dedicate, Echo means to like turn. And I thought this is an interesting point, this dedication of merit. I think it maybe first appears in, I know it's in the 8,000 line Prajnaparamita Sutra, and which is said to be maybe the earliest Mahayana Sutra around the year zero. So I think it's a Mahayana idea to transfer.
Which
the 8,000 line Prajnaparamita, where there's a chapter 6 in that text. We have this in English. It's called Dedication and Rejoicing. So it's this chapter is on rejoicing in the merit of others and dedication. And it's an emptiness, Prajnaparamita Sutra. So the sutra says, the Bodhisattva, while she dedicates, perceives these, we talk about the three wheels sometimes, which are like the dedicator of the merit, the dedicatee, we could say, the one that we're dedicating to, and the goal towards which it's dedicated. We might say the merit itself, but it's commentaries seem to say the one dedicating, the one dedicated to, and the goal towards which it's dedicated, all of these are empty or ungraspable. They all depend on each other, so they can't be found independently. So the sutra says when the Bodhisattva is dedicating merit, she perceives these phenomena as empty and ungraspable, illusory, without a sign to grasp. Then the merit, if they perceive it that way, then the merit becomes dedicated to complete enlightenment. For this Bodhisattva does not settle down in the process of dedication. Which is a way of saying they don't like rest in some fixed idea of like, I'm here giving the merit to you and here's the merit. I think that's what settle down. They don't settle in finding anything actually happening there, and yet they still do the dedication of merit.
Seems like this transferring of merit could also be seen as antidote to pride and possessiveness.
Yes, I think that's right. Yep. Yes. Mm-hmm. Pride and possessiveness, and as well as doubt. Sometimes they say too. Yeah, exactly. We've gathered some joy from practice and like how great that is. That's why I think this is a Mahayana. It arose in the Mahayana with this spirit of compassion. It's not just for our feeling wonderful and our enlightenment. Like we want to immediately share that with everyone and give it away. And of course the great, amazing thing about that is if we give it away, even more comes. We feel even happier about giving it away. And then that happiness we can give away too. So nothing actually gets lost. And I just found today this point that, because I was really trying to contemplate this. What is this dedication of merit? And so one commentary says, good actions and their meritorious result have no direction of their own. Like you can like help feed a hungry person or something and feel good about that, but it doesn't the action just ends there and stops because it doesn't have a direction that it's going necessarily. This is an interesting idea. But the wish or the aspiration or the intention for the good action to lead to awakening or any result for that matter, you can dedicate the merit to your own good health, for example. Maybe it's a little like, maybe a little self-centered, but I think still okay. Like, or my own, like, I need some merit. My practice is really feels like stuck right now. I need to generate some of this merit. And so I help somebody and like, may that merit help my practice. And we could say, and everybody else. You can always include everybody, but we can include ourselves in dedication and merit too. But wherever it's dedicated to, that gives that good action a direction. It gives a direction so the merit, which is the result of the good action, can lead to a desired goal. So I thought that's worth contemplating more, how that works, but I thought that was helpful to me to And that's why they sometimes say you can do a good activity and the merit is like this positive effect can quickly die out right after you do it. But if you dedicate it to enlightenment, to the full awakening of all beings, they say then the result actually never dies out until the goal is reached. Is that some sort of magical thinking, or is there a Dharma principle that we could understand behind that? So I just offer as a contemplation, what does that mean that if you direct it towards this kind of boundless goal, you could say, it keeps it going endlessly. And in our echo...
A momentum,
that's a good word.
That word?
No, that's a good one. Momentum, yeah. And in our sutra chanting, our dedication of merit, they always have the same structure. We first invoke the Buddhas. We say, may all awakened beings extend with true compassion their luminous mirror wisdom. Sometimes we don't add that part, but I think that part kind of says, all the Buddhas listen to us. We're about to make a dedication of merit. And then we say, having chanted the Heart Sutra, is basically you state the meritorious action, the good action. You could say, well, why do we always say what sutra we chanted? It's basically stating the activity that was done. Or sometimes we actually say, having offered incense, light, sweet water, food, and tea, and chanted this, you're listing the practices you did, that you have collected the merit. May the merit from chanting the sutra be dedicated to either all the Buddhas, or in a well-being ceremony, we dedicate it to the sick person, or in a memorial, we dedicate it to the deceased person. So you kind of state what you've done, and then you transfer it. And then there's like a kind of prayer. They all have that form. And we say, what do we say in our morning one? Perfect Wisdom Bodhisattva Manjushri. May our intention be directed towards lasting peace in the Sangha. Yeah, so all these, like, we wish for these kind of like results of the merit. So we dedicate it to a particular person or Buddha, and then we kind of like, we attach a kind of a wish, almost like a prayer to it. So I think that, and if you look at the dedications, they all have that same structure. The echoes, the parinama nas. So, and also one last thought about merit is with especially the emptiness teachings of merit, we can think, how can I here actually like send this positive energy like around the other side of the world to this person? And it sounds almost magical, but if we see like in the teaching of the one mind, that there's only one boundless awareness of which we are all manifestations, then things like that seem like quite possible to me. It seems like then, distance is not an issue. Physical distance is not an issue. And it's not really like me to somebody else. It's like throughout this field of ungraspable and boundless awareness, where just intention is just directing energy throughout there, and it can instantly go anywhere from any appearance to any other appearance. Everything becomes possible. So this dedication of merit, you can read on your own, but it also includes being infinite light is Amitabha, be born in Amitabha's pure land of bliss. Sukhavati is in here too. So this part of that, those pure land teachings, which the whole sutra is dedicated to, are interestingly to me appear in this flower ornament sutra, the Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light. Where the conditions for realizing complete awakening to benefit all beings are like really optimal. I want to be born there. So, dedicating the merit. Thus we finish some looking at these 10 vows of Samanta Bhadra. So now, We can dedicate the merit universally. This one that we chant at the end in Japanese is called Fu Eko, which means universal dedication of merit. Mm-hmm. Means to everyone. We say, may our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.